Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our show this evening, John Motter. He's served in both Iraq and Afghanistan with the U.S. Marine Infantry, and he's a member of the group Iraq Veterans Against the War. John, thank you for being on our program tonight.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So it would be great if you could just tell our listeners a word or two about Iraq Veterans Against the War, which developed in the early days of a broad cross-section of opposition to George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq and the war that claimed so many lives, both in Iraq and, of course, among American and coalition troops over the many years of that war, which unfortunately is still continuing. But say a word about IVAW, if you would.
Yeah, so Iraq Veterans Against the War was founded shortly after the invasion by veterans who had served in Iraq, and the basic foundation was to just oppose the war, but the invasion that they felt was unjust, and the conduct of the military in Iraq. It's since expanded to include the war in Afghanistan as well, and fighting against militarism at home and an inflated defense budget. And I've been with IVAW for about a year now.
Right. And just a status check, when the majority of U.S. troops were withdrawn from Iraq, of course, many have gone back to fight ISIS and a lot of other training and other jobs, but there still is an American presence in Iraq today. What's the status of the group when the majority of troops were withdrawn from Iraq?
Well, we're still fighting against intervention in Iraq, and in addition, we still have a large troop presence in Afghanistan, and obviously we're conducting operations throughout the Middle East, such as in Syria. So our goal is the same, you know, regardless of the fact that troop strength in Iraq isn't what it used to be. We're still very much involved there militarily, and we're seeing a lot of the same unjust and immoral actions conducted on behalf of our government in country there, and we're still trying to bring about an end to the war and educate the people about what has transpired there and what's still continuing to go on.
Well, thank you for that, John. One of the reasons I want to invite you here tonight was to discuss this. Senior Trump administration and military officials recommended, and there were press reports of this last week, that President Trump deploy several thousand additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan to what they termed as, quote, breaking the military deadlock there in this 15-year war, the longest war that the United States has ever been involved with in our long history. John, what's your reaction to this? I don't know if this is the third or fourth major escalation that a presidential administration has executed. It looks like President Trump is going forward with this. I guess we don't know until actually there's an announcement, but this is the recommendation of the Pentagon. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think that notion is pretty absurd, the idea that an additional 5,000 troops is going to break the deadlock when we've been at war there since 2001. When I was there in 2010, we had a troop strength of 100,000. We had over 80,000, I think, for a solid 2 years around there. And obviously the war didn't end then. I really don't think the goal is to end the war. The goal is to prolong it. Some supposed experts see this as basically a never-ending war, a never-ending occupation, something that's going to continue into the next several decades. Sending 5,000 troops, I mean, what is that? It's like one battalion without even all the support that comes along with it. It's just kind of an absurd idea to me that if we haven't, just a basic fundamental idea, like we haven't solved it by now militarily, like I don't think we're going to.
Well, I guess there's one way to view this, and that is we could take it at face value that 5,000 troops would be the beginning and end of this escalation, but it could be the prelude to a lot more troops going back to Afghanistan, which I'm sure is a concern of you and people in Iraq, Veterans Against the War, and a lot of people out there, that we could see Donald Trump move in the complete opposite direction of, you know, what his many campaign promises not to, you know, continue the United States on the track of quote unquote nation building and getting involved in foreign wars. But it turns out, like a lot of things Donald Trump said during the campaign, they're not all that trustworthy. And certainly he's completely doing the opposite of many things he said time and again. I think twice a day you should check your watch to see how many of these campaign promises he's broken. But it's not a laughing matter, of course, John. What are you concerned that this could be like, you know, the camel's nose under the tent kind of thing, that this could be a prelude to a really big escalation?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever been the case that any time an administration has said we just need a couple thousand more troops there, that we've ever capped it out at that point. You look at the surge in Iraq in 2006, and then Afghanistan in 2009 and 10. It's always just the tip of something bigger. And I think historically, that's what we've seen in Afghanistan. There's no reason to think it wouldn't continue to increase. Even if it did stay at 5,000, there's still 5,000 more service members who don't need to go there, who don't need to risk their life for an objective that's unattainable. And I really don't think this administration is, you know, regardless of what he said, it was safe to assume that he was going to continue our aggressive military foreign policy. And any other previous war, we've just ramped up troop deployments and stacked up casualties alongside it. So this shouldn't seem like a small number to people. I mean, it's someone's kids going over there, someone's kids who aren't going to come back, you know, even if it's not every family or every community that's affected. This is clearly not the best course of action, and it's something completely avoidable. So I would hope people would be aware of that and speak up and stand up against it.
We're speaking with John Motter, who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan while with the U.S. Marine Infantry, and he's a member of the group Iraq Veterans Against the War. We're talking about the Pentagon advice to Donald Trump, which appears to have been approved to deploy several thousand, up to 5,000 new U.S. troops into the war in Afghanistan, America's longest war. John, one of the things that's been said about this troop increase is that it's a way to pressure the Taliban to come to the negotiating table and end this war. Is there any hope that the Taliban will do that, will follow the game plan of the Pentagon to feel the pressure and, you know, work towards a peaceful solution?
Well, boy, we sure put the pressure on in summer of 2010, and I really didn't see them, you know, begging for us to come to the table with them. It's a pretty ridiculous notion that you're going to fight a war of ideology as though it's a war of attrition. I mean, if you look back at Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh said himself that if, you know, 10 of us have to die for everyone the enemy killed, it will still be deemed a victory. That's the same kind of mentality we're facing here. There's no way you're going to kill every last Taliban, and certainly even if you tried to do that, you're going to inflict so many civilian casualties that you're just going to create, you know, 10 more Taliban or supporters for everyone you kill. That's just the fundamental idea behind these wars, like, and the fact that they are never ending. No, they're not going to come negotiate. And if you look at the PLO and other organizations, and if you understand, or Viet Cong, if you understand tenets of fourth generation warfare, which I really don't think the Pentagon does, negotiating is just a tactic. It's a delaying, it's a stalling tactic that they use. It's what they did in Vietnam, the Paris Accords, until they can regroup their forces and launch more physical offensive campaigns. So if we push them to an extent where they take so many casualties and they lose so much ground, they said, like, okay, well, we'll negotiate with you. We certainly haven't changed their hearts or minds. They're going to continue fighting. And then, like, once we did pull our troops back, they're just going to take over all the ground that we gained from them. So, yeah, that, from a strategic standpoint, that doesn't hold water. And once again, morally, like, even if somehow, you know, continuing these wars and inflicting all the casualties we have and destroying the country as we have, if that doesn't upset you, you should understand that, you know, this isn't really a winnable war, certainly not with the tactics we've been taking and the military force we have at our disposal.
John, having served in Afghanistan, what is it that you could tell our listeners that they may not understand about the conflict there, about the Taliban, about public support or opposition for either the government or the Taliban? The Taliban were in power for some years, and you certainly heard a lot of horror stories here in the United States press about the repressive measures against women, about the public floggings, the public beheadings, the prohibition against music or dance. It just seemed like a very dire situation for the majority of the people in Afghanistan. But it appears that there is at least some support for the Taliban to this day. And what's your experience with the average Afghani and the choices they have in terms of, you know, aligning themselves with the government, the U.S. forces, the coalition forces from NATO, or the Taliban? I mean, what are the things that we really don't understand about this conflict?
It is tough. It's pretty complex. It's never been simply black and white. And when you're on the ground, you see and understand a lot more of that. I think public support amongst Afghanis for the Taliban just comes from a desire for stability, even if it's under, you know, a terribly brutal regime. It's still better than constant war for a lot of these people. Education, obviously, there's little to no schooling there, you know, certainly not outside major cities. So people really understanding or believing that there's more to life or that they have more of an opportunity than just surviving, that doesn't really exist. And another thing, working with the Afghani National Police and Afghani National Army, which we call ANA and AMT, you see that a lot of these guys, like, aren't really different than the Taliban. In fact, some of them are former Taliban. The ANP commander we were working with was former Taliban. That's one of the reasons he was so effective in RAO, because he knew a lot of the tactics. He knew a lot of the local people in the area who were Taliban. These people, they just switch sides. Like, when I say these people, I'm talking about the members of military and police leaders. Whichever the way the wind's blowing, you know, whoever they feel is can best serve their needs at the time. They're not fighting for country. They're not fighting for peace or some kind of, you know, greater ideal. They're serving their own needs, or they're just trying to doing whatever they think they need to do to survive. Like, a lot of them are fighting simply to, you know, because they were threatened by the Taliban and they had to get out of Dodge, so they joined the military and are simply fighting for their own survival and don't really feel a need to conform to, you know, laws of land warfare and rules of engagement. In coming back, you know, I would hear stories. A friend of mine was our interpreter in Afghanistan, and he had a lot of insights I didn't have because he had conversations with the civilians there, with the police and army leaders. And as bad as the Taliban were, like, the guys that we are supporting to take over aren't much better or worse. Like, they murdered detainees. Some of them were pedophiles. It was just, like, a lot of shocking stuff to hear that, you know, the supposed better world we're building for them and the government we're trying to put in place is, you know, in reality, not going to be much different than the Taliban. So it's not to say that it's not to be sympathetic to the Taliban. Obviously, they were, you know, a bunch of terrible people, or and still are. But It's just that the alternative we're offering them is hardly different, and the way we're getting there is by continuing to kill members of these communities, take away their livelihood. You see that on the ground, too. That's another insight I can offer. When you're trying to conduct a counterinsurgency, but the Marines you're fighting with don't even understand the tenets of counterinsurgency. They're just kind of going out, and to an extent, we too just are trying to make it day to day. After a while, you stop caring about a safer world or a safer Afghanistan, and most of the soldiers and Marines over there do not have the highest opinions of the people there, so you can't really say that we're really sympathetic and want a better future for these people when we have such demeaning attitudes and opinions of them, and we'll basically do whatever it takes to make sure we get back alive. And then there's other completely the absurdities that you only see in war, patrolling through poppy fields and receiving orders to skirt the poppy fields because we don't want to destroy their crops and upset the farmers because we're trying to work with them and win their hearts and minds. When we know full well that the opium that they're harvesting from the poppies is being sold to fund the Taliban and the war against us. So we're protecting the Taliban's livelihood. It's just completely ridiculous, all the things you see over there.
Yeah, and I would just add one other thing that you could shed some light on, having served in Afghanistan with the Marine Infantry, is that there's been constant complaints and reports about how the nation of Pakistan offers safe haven to a lot of these Taliban leaders, and certainly a lot of Taliban troops find shelter there and organize the fight from Pakistani territory. Yet the nation of Pakistan, the government of Pakistan, is one of the nations that receives the most foreign aid and military assistance from the U.S. government of any nation in the world. Yet there's no quid pro quo to shut this back door down for the Taliban. That's got to be frustrating for someone who's in the fight there to understand that set of issues. And the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, is deeply enmeshed in organizing and assisting the Taliban fighting the United States and the Afghan government.
Yeah, absolutely. And they helped get the Taliban its start. I mean, they were the ones funding the more extremist groups of the Mujahideen through the CIA, and CIA knew the groups that they were funding weren't the best people and didn't have the highest opinions of the United States, but their infinite wisdom and their completely short-sighted goals, we as a United States created the Taliban with Pakistan, and then when things like 9/11 happened, and the American public is completely clueless as to how this happened.
You mean, we cultivated the Al-Qaeda and some of the leadership there, including Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen fighting the Russians during the Cold War, right? And then this is what's called blowback. These guys come and attack us after they've been funded and trained by the U.S.
Continuing on today, obviously, because, the goal isn't to end the war. The goal never has been to end the war, to end war in general. It's to prolong these wars because they're extremely profitable for a small group of people. It's not really, none of this stuff is really a mystery once you figure out how much money is being made by the people involved.
Right. And just one other factor I'll throw in there, and there's nothing we probably have time to talk about, and I don't have a lot of knowledge of it, but, from my understanding, Pakistan is involved with the Taliban because they do not want to see an independent Afghan government prosper, given the fact that they would think their arch enemy, India, would have some influence there on their frontier there. In Afghanistan, and this is, all part of a complicated puzzle, as you said earlier, that has a lot to do with all sorts of regional conflicts, not just Pakistan, the Taliban, and Afghanistan, but includes India as well. So a lot to know there that I don't know much about, I have to say. But John,
I can't speak to all that, but I can just tell you what I've seen on the ground, what what we're being told back home and what we're told we're supposed to be doing and what is happening, and in reality, what is actually happening.
Well, I just have one final question for you, John, and that is, having fought on the ground there with the Marines in Afghanistan, and all that you've learned on the ground face-to-face in that nation, what do you make of the fact that we hear constantly from the Pentagon and U.S. politicians that the United States cannot let Afghanistan fall to the Taliban because it would be a safe haven for terrorists and pose an existential threat to this country, basically predicting that if Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, we'd have another 9/11 or many more 9/11 attacks on the United States. This is always in the background as a rationale for continuing this longest war in U.S. history. What do you say to that, and what is an alternative policy? Something we can't do in 2 minutes, but, give us the bare bones of it.
That argument seems pretty flawed. One, just if you look at the number of Americans who died in the war on terror since 9/11, is the fact that we prevented another 9/11 really worth that, being that thousands of Americans died anyway? So, that kind of, mathematical argument, we're saving lives by doing this, simply isn't true. Americans are still dying. These places are still safe havens for terrorists. We're facing domestic terrorists at home, and that's clearly not a priority when nightclubs are getting shot up. I really just see this all, if you see who is backing our members of Congress, who their major donors are, it's clearly a conflict of interest for defense contractors who have a vested interest in us being at war and continuing warring. For them to be funding the members of Congress who send us to war, determine whether or not we go. But people don't really seem to have much of a problem with that and don't really make the connection there. Just the idea that these places are going to be havens for terrorists. I don't have necessarily the answer to that. I can't really say that I'm complete isolationist, but I know what we're doing now when we drop a bomb and we dropped it on the wrong house and we killed 20 civilians, you just turned an entire village against you and you just radicalized 10 more people who are going to want to destroy America and Americans. So I don't really see how that's preventing future terrorists.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you, John, for joining us tonight and talking about your own experience, what you learned in serving both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you would, leave our listeners with a web address for Iraq Veterans Against the War, a group that you're an active member in.
Yeah, our website is ivaw.org, and we're currently in the middle of a name change. We're now called About Face, but the website is the same.
ivaw.org right now, right?
All right, yep. Thanks, okay. Scott.
John, thanks so much. I appreciate you being here, and I'd like to talk again, continue the conversation at a future date. Hope we can.
All right, great. Yeah, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's John Motter. Served in both Iraq and Afghanistan with the U.S. Marine Infantry, and he's a member of the group Iraq Veterans Against the War, ivaw.org.